Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by the all-new 2015 Jeep Renegade.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 302 for September 11th of 2015, forecasting the hits at Frankfurt. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Gary Vasilash here. We find ourselves yet again doing another great show.
We do, on a beautiful fall day. Getting ready for winter in Detroit.
But I was, in
Las Vegas this week where it was 104 degrees,
I'm really happy.
Stephanie Brindley, who was with me there.
And, yeah, we should mention Stephanie Brindley from IHS Automotive is here with us today, as well as Todd Lassa from Automobile Magazine.
And hello,
great
John.
Great to have you here, Todd.
Good to be here.
And you too, Steph.
Thank you.
Thanks. And speaking about being here today, next week you will not be here. Because you are going to be somewhere else?
Where you are going to be.
And that will be?
Frankfurt, Germany. Right. We'll be putting up interviews from the Frankfurt show Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. We're going to be interviewing a whole bunch of people, showing what the new cars are all about, and should be a lot of fun. You're going to be there, too.
Yes.
I think all four of us are going to be there.
I believe so, yeah. I'll be there.
That's the case.
So that's perfect, because we need to talk about what are we going to see at this show? What really matters? Gary, what's at the top of your list? What's a must-see for you?
Well, I think that one of the most fascinating things is probably not one that's high on many people's lists. It's the Golf GTI Golf Club Sport, which would be their 40th anniversary GTI. And I think what makes it sort of interesting is
Oliver Schmidt loves it.
Oliver Schmidt loves it. Yeah, I'm sure we'll run into Oliver over there. But so what they've done for this thing is they've increased the horsepower by 34.5 horsepower. So it's 261 horsepower, this thing. So it's the most powerful GTI ever. But I think what the very fascinating thing is that, I mean, they have this, it's almost like a Fast and Furious button, as it were, that they're saying that for a short time, about 10 seconds, this is what Volkswagen says, about 10 seconds, the driver can increase the engine power by additional 10% to more than 286 horsepower using an overboost function.
I wonder where they got that idea.
Huh? It's ludicrous mode.
Yes.
So, I mean,
it sounds like Indy's push to pass button that they've had for a long time.
A little bit of that, but certainly you think of the Tesla Model S and the special buttons.
And that's what they do? They just, bolt down the wastegate, clamp it down?
And it just says that what you do is you just hammer the throttle, and then you get that boost. You know, so it's almost like you're injecting nitro and the tank runs out, but no tank, no nitro.
There have been a few turbo cars with temporary horsepower increases like that. It does bump up into Golf R territory, though, almost, which is, I think, 300 or 305 horsepower, something like that.
Yeah, so it's got a 0 to 60 time, 5.9 seconds, and 155 miles an hour top speed. So
sort of
a cool car, but, I mean, it's clearly, I mean, there are these more exotic things that will certainly be there.
Look, I remember back in the 80s when the then head of Renault Engineering said it would be impossible, to put more than 150 horsepower in a front-wheel drive car. Just couldn't take it. Wouldn't be able to handle, wouldn't be able to drive. You just snap the half shafts. So we clearly know that all these stats that you're spouting are clearly impossible. Steph, what do you want? What do you want to go see at the show?
You know, there's interesting that we're going to have a mix of convertibles and SUVs and a lot of premium stuff going on there. There's a little Cactus convertible concept. There's a Peugeot convertible concept, an S-Class convertible.
Is anyone going to sell these cars?
No. Convertible market isn't really going anywhere.
So why is
going somewhere, but it's going in the wrong direction, unfortunately.
It's not very strong. Well, it still can provide, a level of interest for the brand. I mean, you can think it's sexy, you can think it's cool, even if it's not.
I know, but why lose a bunch of money doing so?
Yeah, but
so you get this 1 week flurry of headlines, and then nobody shows up at the showroom.
Okay, but
do
if they're concepts,
going to lose money on the S class.
I mean, and if they're concepts, a. It's just looks it's cool, just, right?
I agree, right?
And then, Peugeot Fractal is just looks
and then if it's the S-Class, they already have the damn thing. They just take a Sawzall and just take that top off.
We always have concerns about, there's always something new that is going to put an end to the convertible. And, of course, we've got rollover standards, and you can't put side curtains in a convertible the way you can in a hardtop car and that sort of thing. But, you know, I was around as... three of us were around the last time convertibles went away, and that was in the 1970s. Remember, after OPEC and air conditioning.
Oh, I remember when people bought the last convertible that Cadillac built.
Exactly.
Until it wasn't the last one that they built.
And actually, after that, there was a dearth of them from the 76 Cadillac Eldorado up until the K-car convertibles, I guess. And then we had the Mazda Miata, which kind of replaced... For me, at least, the Honda CRX is kind of the two-seater to have if you didn't have a lot of money. And that revived it. But, you know, the question now is, are people just too much interested in having a high ride height, you know, kind of little being caught in inside a car where you don't roll the windows down except to... Well, you don't even have to use that for the toll roads anymore because you've got your little...
the electronic easy pass.
Exactly.
Well, one of the interesting things I think with the convertible market is as the U.S. market has picked back up, convertibles haven't been where people were spending their money. But we came out of a recession, and frankly, people replaced what they needed to first. We haven't really gotten further along in this economic recovery to start buying the fun stuff. So the first thing out of the gate wasn't going to be convertibles. In Europe, we're still struggling and trying to slowly get that market back. Convertibles are not the first thing on everybody's mind right now in terms of what you're going to go buy. You might be interested in looking at it, but it's going to take a little bit before we see some of that. But overall, we don't see the convertible market growing. We don't see it going away, but we don't see it growing.
So, okay, in the U.S. market, so what, there's a Corvette convertible, right. A Mustang convertible, the aforementioned Miata.
Camaro convertible.
Okay, Camaro. Is there any?
Running out of convertibles.
No, I mean, is there any? You know, as you said, you know, fun cars, Camaros and Mustangs,
well, still 3 Series or
and
stuff. Yeah.
You know, well, and they. But I mean, I'm talking about domestically built cars, right? I mean, so if you want to get the family sedan with a convertible, is there one?
Not a family sedan. Not one. If you want a decent sized back seat.
We'll have a Cascada in a little bit, but that's
maybe a little bit, but not
the
certainly
Cascada,
not.
Which is the
Opel,
the Buick.
The 1959,
the Buick that's not from Opel,
but that's not here yet.
Certainly not the 1959 wide track Pontiac, which was designed that way to have a decent sized back seat by moving the rear wheels out. You don't have anybody worried about providing a kind of a permanent, if you will, a back seat where you take a lot of people. A long distance. I think, since you mentioned convertibles, the kind of the counterpoint to that is the Nissan XUV concept, the X concept, I think they're calling it, which they've only sent out one teaser. And there's a lot of speculation, and we've already kind of discussed that this speculation might be a bit overdone, that this might actually be the replacement for the Nissan Z car. Now, whether it is or not, well, if it's being thought of as possibly the replacement for the Z car, that's kind of the counterpoint to Stephanie's claim that the convertible is going to be the big thing at Frankfurt. That wasn't your claim, but talking about that, in that XUVs, these compact or subcompact crossovers are now considered there's a lot of desire for them, that this
well,
embodies
like crazy.
People want them because originally they were sport utility vehicles, and supposedly there was some sport in the sport utility. There really wasn't, but especially when they became crossovers they become this kind of amorphous, kind of bland kind of car. I think the Lexus RX was just kind of you could run a picture of a Lexus RX and say, this is a picture of a car. And it just kind of fit. And now you've got everybody rushing into that category and into a smaller size. You've got people, obviously, these are two-row vehicles. So people are buying them not because they have a family or plan to have a family. You probably have some younger people or some older people buying them, and they're the hottest thing.
So you're suggesting this Nissan X will be a crossover convertible?
No, I'm not. No convertible.
How'd that cross cabrio work out for them?
I think among the average buyer, this segment is kind of taking over as something that's a little bit different than the Toyota Camrys and Honda Accords of the world. Something that's got a little something extra. Except those of us who like to drive convertibles or drive sports cars look at it and say, oh, that's pretty boring. But they're selling the hell out of them, and they may be taking over for convertibles.
So what do you want to see at Frankfurt? What are you looking forward to?
Oh, I'm looking forward to a surprise, which would include that Nissan concept, since we know very little bit about it. I'm looking forward to... I've already had a sneak preview of the Bentley Bottega. And I think that's going to be a...
You mean the EXP9F, don't you?
EXP9F.
We've all seen that years ago.
And I have to say, as someone who's not a big fan of sport utility vehicles, when I saw this thing in the tin a little while ago, I kind of got it. I understood that, you know, I overused the very overused lead about how Ettore Bugatti said Bentley makes the fastest trucks in Europe. And now they really do have the fastest truck in Europe. It goes 187 miles an hour, and while that concept from a few years ago didn't look very good, the Bentayga I think looks like a Bentley. It looks, whether you like the design or not, it fits. If you think of what the Mulsanne is, if you think of even what the Continental is, a big grill with a big body behind it. It kind of fits. I think it makes more sense for Bentley to have a big sport utility than it makes sense for Porsche to have sport utilities. And Porsche obviously has done very well with the sport utilities. So
transformed the company. So here's a question. Rolls-Royce is also going to be showing a convertible, the Dawn. We should talk about that.
Yep.
Are they making a mistake? Shouldn't Rolls-Royce have come out with the uber-luxurious crossover or SUV?
They'll have both. I mean, they're working on one. No, not at the show, but I mean, Rolls will have a big crossover, I think, within a year, right? And the interesting thing about this is that Rolls claims that this shares very little sheet metal with...
You're talking about the Dawn.
The
convertible version of the Wraith.
Of the Wraith. Rolls says that it shares only, 20% of the sheet metal or something like that? I forgot what's...
Probably everything from the A-pillar back is probably unique, is my guess.
Yeah. So, you know, when you're selling cars in that atmosphere and that price, you know, it doesn't matter. You've got margin for it. And obviously this is... You don't need to sell a lot of them, and you're not going to sell a lot of them because it's Rolls-Royce. So I'm sure they'll do fabulously well with them, you know, as they do with all the others.
And unlike the hardtop version of the Wraith, that where you're going to have that headliner,
headliner
that looks like the Starry Night, you can just open the top at night and you can just look up and there it is.
As long as you get outside of the city enough to...
That reminded me of the Avalon Theater in Milwaukee on the South Side, which was built in the late 20s and had one of those pinhole roofs to make it look like...
Planetarium roof.
Right.
And, you know, SUV growth has fed on itself as well. As long as we keep saying it's the popular segment, we're driving that a little bit in the way that we talk about it. But that's where the growth is. And car segments had matured. I mean, there was a car in every little spot, and pretty much. And that's where we're at next, is growing the SUV thing.
Do you think that these uber luxe SUVs are basically predicated by... You know, people sitting over in Europe and going, damn, they're selling a lot of Tahoes in Saudi Arabia. This is not right. They ought to be buying our vehicles.
I think part of it is the Middle Eastern market does a lot for, you know, if I lived out there and if I was fabulously wealthy, I'd want something like a sport utility instead of a car, too.
Here's an interesting
fact. Well, it's one of your seven cars,
you know,
anyway.
The United States exports nearly as many vehicles to the Middle East as it does to Europe.
Yeah.
And, you know, the population comparison is not even close. I mean, what is it? Yeah, Europe's, 400 million people plus, and or even more than that. It's got to be 500 million plus. And I don't know what the Middle East is, but it's a fraction of that. But they love Slades and Tahoes and Mustangs. And
It's a reaction to what consumers want, because consumers are buying them. They do like to sit up higher and SUVs. So, you know, you're getting that.
Mm-hmm. But the part that has me scratching my head is that you always have the manufacturer says, well, we needed to get into this segment. And I'm talking about anybody from Bentley to Porsche to all the others that have come along in the last 10 years or so. And they say, well, you know, we've got the guy who's got a Continental in his garage, and he's driving an Escalade or something too. He's got several cars, and he has a sport utility. Well, we want that sport utility to be a Bentley next time instead of a Cadillac or, you know, whatever. And yet, if you look at someone like Volkswagen, you'd say, well, okay, if the guy's got Porsches in his garage, does he need a Porsche sport utility? If he's got Bentleys in his garage, won't he be happy with an Audi, which is going to share a lot of components with that Bentley or that Porsche anyway? But nope, you have to have it covered all the way through every brand possible. I kind of don't get that. On the other hand, they're making tons of money on it, so I do get it.
Yeah, right now, but I got to tell you, you know, when I look at Mercedes, BMW, and Audi, man, they got a lot of models. I think way too many. I think
agree.
At some point, you know, they're going to hit the glass ceiling there, and they're going to wake up and go, hey, we got way too many models.
Okay, when you say the ceiling, do you think that they're going too high or they're going too low in terms of what they're bringing to
I would just
to
say
market?
Too many.
Too many.
You know, going down low is going to get them volume, and that's why they're going down that way, because everybody's got to be able to amortize all this technology needed to meet safety and fuel efficiency and CO2 emission standards. You need volume to cover that, and that's a key reason why they're going so much down market. I just think they got too many models. I can't even keep them all straight myself, and part of my job is to keep it all straight.
I don't think any of us can anymore. We need more people in the business, I guess.
Yeah, we didn't know.
That was a joke.
They may say that, but at the same time, if they're able to, all the manufacturers are getting much better at understanding how to effectively share and amortize and make sure that they can come up with another model that doesn't cost as much as it might look like to cost. I do wonder how far they can go, because it's great.
Aren't they kind of chasing their tail? They go, oh, we have to have common architecture so we can share all these components and drive down the cost. And like, hey, look, we saved all this cost. Let's do more models. And there go all the savings.
I do agree there does seem to be a point where there's just not going to be any space to add anymore.
But I think I want to add the point, though, that even if they've got too many models, if you look at all these luxury brands or premium brands that are adding sport utilities, and you look at the price of a sport utility compared to its roughly equivalent sedan, and the prices are significantly higher, and they sell them with lots of equipment on them, and they print money. Cadillac on the Escalade paid that tooling off right away. Lincoln with the Navigator, same thing. They're too hard a segment to get out of now.
Yeah.
And now you've got, to your point, Mercedes slicing it up with the coupe version of the GL class or whatever. I can't keep them straight.
The coupe versions are the ones that confuse me.
The coupe versions, but they're moneymakers.
They are.
They weren't a moneymaker for Acura. Acura tried it and got out of it, but everybody else, well, BMW and Mercedes seem to be doing okay with it.
There's another SUV that's coming to Frankfurt that we didn't mention, and that's the Jaguar F-Pace.
F-Pace, right.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
So, you know, we talked about this a little bit last week about how well Land Rover is doing and how not well Jaguar is doing because it doesn't have one.
That's right. And speaking of that, we're also going to see the new Volkswagen Tiguan. And that's one that's high on my list to go see and find out if these guys finally got it right. I can't believe how
long
they can't nail, you know, the map when it comes to the American market. You know, we were talking last week. I'm driving the brand new Golf. There's not a USB port in the car. I can't believe it. And, you know, all I'm saying is this Tiguan just better be exactly what they need for the market.
So they finally came around a cup holder to look at the USB ports later.
Well, and I'm going to be skeptical about the new Tiguan because, to your point about the Golf, I mean, the Golf sold pretty well last month in the United States. I think it was like only several hundred units fewer than the Volkswagen Passat. That's bad news.
Looking it up as
that's bad news for Volkswagen. That's not good news because
they're just cannibalizing themselves.
No, they're just selling Volkswagens to Volkswagen people. They're not expanding their market. Volkswagen people love the Golf, and it's not an American-centric car, if you will. It's fine that they're doing well with that, but the fact that it's catching the Passat in sales is bad news for Volkswagen, because the Passat is a very American car. Was I right or wrong, Gary? I know it was. I want to say it was 7,000 for the total golf
for,
sales?
For year to date or for
No, for
August.
Just for August. Did I have that wrong?
Let's see. Golf, well, I've got it broken down it's
yeah, there's
Volkswagen
a total number. You have to look at the whole number there.
Well, I'm seeing Jetta is 11,000.
Yeah.
Passat's 7,400. Golf was not that strong.
They had a pretty good month.
They've had pretty good growth month. I didn't look up my number either. Well, the interesting one of the interesting things.
29.
The wagon is the Jetta wagon, right? So you've got a little bit of
Jetta
got a little bit
Jetta
of
wagon, 110
shifting, and now it's the Golf. Right. So the Golf is doing.
Doesn't matter either one. You know how to name it. It still doesn't have a USB port.
It still doesn't have a USB port, and they still are missing on that. And even though it is seeing good sales growth, it's not dominant in the segment.
Mm-mm. So anyway, that's one on my list that I will definitely get to the Volkswagen stand to see the Tiguan. The other one I'm dying to see is this e-tron Quattro from Audi. Is Gary? So we're going to get a break here, but we got to come back and talk about it.
But here we're getting into the alternative powertrain sort of thing, which I was talking to someone yesterday from Auto Blog Green about this, and it's sort of an interesting observation about what we're not seeing so much at Frankfurt. So we'll get to that when we come back.
You know, nobody's talking green anymore at auto shows. That disappeared. We'll be back. We got more to talk about. But first, we got to give a great shout out to our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back.
So
you were going to say something.
Okay, so the e-tron Quattro crossover concept. So we go back to the beginning. We're talking again about a crossover, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and so this whole architectural phenomenon that seems to be holding forth at Frankfurt in a big way. But you know, when they came out, they're basically talking about how this is going to be, you know, competing with Tesla, and it's
Model X, and you know that the Model X has been delayed quite a bit for a couple of years now, and so it's
the they can't get the lever on the back seats to work.
The timing's very interesting. I've got to wonder.
I can't believe that excuse.
I've got to wonder about those doors. You know. Mm-hmm.
Well, they said they figured that out. It's other things that we're giving them.
Yeah, like I think it's the last thing. It's like the seatback recliner on the second row seat.
But I was talking to Anton Waldman, our friend from Silicon Valley, who is the Tesla viewer, and he said he's seen a lot of those driving around. He says they're gorgeous. He says they're just fabulous looking cars. He's just really not
about
them. But so we have Audi, you know, coming to do this. But, you know, so I was talking to Sebastian Blanco of Autoblog Green, and I said, Sebastian, what are you looking forward to see at Frankfurt? Is there something that's really important that's going to be introduced there? And, you know, because obviously he's just worried about green vehicles. And he thought, and he thought, and he thought, and he said, no. There's really nothing that is of significance. He said, everybody seems to be rolling out, you know, a plug-in version of something or other. But he said, basically, you know, if you think about it, and he made an interesting point. He said, okay, so look at the auto shows for General Motors for the next several runs, that, you know, the new Volt is coming out and the new Bolt will be coming out. What are they going to have after that?
Plug-in CT6.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it, though.
No,
right.
XT5.
Oh.
Before that. Yeah.
XT5 plug-in?
No.
Oh, yeah.
XT5.
But I'm saying from a green standpoint.
Yeah.
Well, and here it's still pretty much being driven by California, by the California mandate. And so you have to do it, and you sell a few to those who just want to own that sort of car. But it's been pretty limited. Meanwhile, you've got $2 or $2.25 per gallon gas.
In the U.S., States. But in Europe, it's still $7 a gallon.
Yeah, so. How do the Euros get by the CO2 standards? I mean, it's just like you talk to, you know, suppliers primarily, and they're like figuring out ways that they're going to be able to help the automakers hit that. And here are these guys saying, let's have an SUV. I mean, isn't this counter to what they have to deal with?
Sure it is, but that's what people are buying, and that's the problem with all these emissions regulations, is the pesky public just won't go along with the program. They want to go out and buy what they want.
But then the pesky politicians are going to demand that the automaker pay them money for not meeting the standards.
That's just going to be interesting to kind of watch it, because clearly consumers are not in line with regulations.
Look,
their demands are
well,
not
and but we're right. But we're also talking about what we call CUVs instead of SUVs, and think about SUVs the way they were 12, 15 years ago. These are car-based SUVs. Many of them are sold with two-wheel drive instead of four-wheel drive.
Here or in Europe?
In Europe. I mean, in Europe now, you finally have kind of a convergence of European and American tastes with the B and C segment CUVs, where both Europeans and Americans are interested.
And even China. Throw China. I mean, this is a global phenomenon.
Yeah.
And the higher fuel, the lower fuel efficiency of those vehicles is not the same as it was if you compare, say, a full-sized SUV versus a full-size car.
Sort of like the Bentley with 600 horsepower that'll be coming out.
Well, yeah, but obviously they're hoping to sell many more Tiguans to offset those Bentley Bentaygas. And they're going to do a plug-in hybrid of that as well. So, Bentley's going to have that covered to a certain extent. You know, how many rich people want to own a plug-in hybrid? I don't know.
We'll have them out there. And part of it is alternative powertrains, whether it's a plug-in hybrid, less so with EVs, but are now just part of the landscape. So you don't need to have an auto show that's all green and says, we're introducing this new technology to the public, because it's just filtered through so much. I mean,
maybe. I think the public just doesn't care. The public cares about the environment. They clearly do. But not to the point where automakers have got to scream how green they are anymore. And, you know, we talked about this on the show, I want to say at least 2 years ago, might have been three, of how all of a sudden the green theme went away at every auto show. And now all anyone wants to talk about is connected car and autonomous car. Mm-hmm. That's the big thing. And there's a big autonomous / connected thing going on at Frankfurt that I'm going to spend most of the second day trying to learn what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's not forget that one of the supposed advantages of autonomy and connected cars is that you'll save fuel as well. You'll save gasoline and diesel or, oil as well.
Well, and back to your point about the fuel cost between an SUV and a sedan, I mean, that's a lot of it right now. If you really prefer sitting up higher, the penalty is not that great. And it's a car that costs more than the sedan, so you've already chosen to spend more on transportation than you have to by picking the SUV to begin with. The difference in fuel economy is just close enough that people can accept paying a little bit more.
And at the last Detroit show, a little conversation with Jim O'Sullivan of Mazda, he spoke about how they're seeing buyers trading in midsize cars for C-segment CUVs and compact cars for B-segment CUVs. Well, they were just launching theirs, but that's where they saw the market going. So people are going down a size as they raise the ride height. Again, these things bore the heck out of me, but they're probably not losing a lot of fuel economy unless they go with the all-wheel drive option, and even then it's just a few.
Okay, let me ask you this. Okay, so everybody is saying, oh, everybody's going down a size and they're going to SUVs and so on. Is everyone going down a size because the cost, the average cost of a vehicle is getting so damn high?
Yes. Because the CUVs cost more. A C-segment CUV costs more than a C-segment compact car, right?
Yes, that's part of it. Part of it is if you look at the replacing something that's a few years old, and the B-segment cars have gotten bigger and the C-segment cars have gotten bigger, and that's happened in the SUV segment as well. So if you've got somebody replacing an 8-year-old Civic and they go down to the HRV, that's probably closer in size than it might sound.
Okay, but
so our sizes keep growing and growing and growing.
Okay, but the HRV, which is their B segment crossover, is predicated on the Fit platform. Okay, so the Fit car is down one from the Civic. So let's say I'm the person who owns the 8-year-old Civic, and I spent what, $18,000 on it when I bought it 8 years ago? Less? I don't know.
Somewhere in there.
Okay,
anywhere from 15 to 18, depending on which one you bought.
So now I go into the Honda store and I say, I want to buy another Civic. I love the car. It's fantastic. It's been bulletproof. It's had everything. I want to buy one, and you know, so what is it going to cost me? So what will it cost me now?
22 to 25.
22 to 25. Okay, so we've gone from 15 to 18 to 22 to 25. And then I go, holy shit, that's a lot of money. And then the guy says, but look, what? I got this HRV over here, and I can get this for
22.
Sure. Exactly.
So you're
right?
Not.
So basically, I'm not going down in size because this is a big trend that everybody's doing. I'm going down in size because I can't afford to do otherwise.
I totally agree.
And you buy the HRV, and you're going to be able to fold down the rear seat and put your $3,000 bicycle in the back there.
Well,
meanwhile, everybody going into pickups is getting bigger and spending $50,000 on these trucks.
Yeah.
You know, it's so you know you got two things going.
We're dealing with the increase in fuel and vehicle prices largely with longer loan terms. Too many people walk in and go, I want to spend $500 a month or $1,000 a month or whatever it is. And you just make the loan last a little bit longer, and you get there. Is you know, we are. Average car price is like $32,000, which is a lot of money, I think, for an average car price. But car sales are still roaring. People are figuring out a way to, and the average is 32. So not everybody is going in and buying a $22,000 car. There's plenty of space going on in the luxury and in the premium in the $40,000 and the $50,000 and the $60,000 cars in order to keep your average that high. Whether it's feeling much more confident and feeling like you can afford it and you're not going to lose your job next month and everything's going to be good, and a combination of decently low interest rates and long loan terms.
Is quoting the average price misleading? You know, because, you know, you throw in some Mercedes AMG S's in there, and all of a sudden the average is skewed up. Shouldn't
yeah,
we be talking
numbers
about
of
the
those
mean? Would that change it?
Are still small.
I don't know what the mean is. So
I've never heard anybody quote what the mean is.
No. The average does get pulled up a little bit by that. But if you don't have that side of the segment, it wouldn't come up. I still think that people are buying plenty of cars that are costing a lot more than 32.
Yeah.
I think even though I don't have any of the data or studies that Stephanie might be able to quote or have from IHS, I think just anecdotally or just kind of obviously that especially since the Great Recession, we've seen the new car market as much as it has grown since 2010 to it'll be 17.5 million this year. I think we're seeing that. If you're buying a new car, you're probably upper middle class or better. And, you know, part of that is that the other thing we talk about is how the average age of the car now on the road is something like 11 years. And so cars are lasting longer. An 11-year-old car isn't as bad as it was, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And on top of that, you've got middle class people or middle-class people on down maybe buying the off-lease three-year-old Audis from the upper-middle-class people who are leasing, not buying them, actually. So that average price of a car probably doesn't mean very much certainly not when we talk about the premium brands, especially the European premium brands, because, you know, those are very heavily leased vehicles. And so then you should be talking about not is it $30,000, $40,000, or $50,000, but is it $299, $399, or $499 a month?
Mm-hmm. That's certainly an impact on it as well.
Hey, speaking of cars that are going to be at the Frankfurt show, what do you guys make of this wild Honda concept? I think it's called the 2 and 4.
2 and 4.
And 2 and 4,
it looks
yeah.
like kind of a four-wheel motorcycle in a way.
The first teaser I saw reminded me I was on the Acura RSX.
Here we got a picture of
it. There it is.
On the screen.
The first teaser was an overhead shot, and you could only see the right side of the car and the open wheels. You could tell that the engine was on the right side of the car. It reminded me of something Honda did for its 50th anniversary in the late 90s, and I got to drive one actually on a Honda press trip for the Acura RSX in 2000 or 2001. It was called a side-by-side. Now, today a side-by-side is one of those four-wheel off-road motorcycles that the Honda motorcycle division sells. But back then it was they just built 50 of them for their birthday, and it had a motorcycle engine to your right. And it was unlike this, it had an enclosed cockpit.
and it had a sequential, I think, a five-speed manual box. And on this trip, they allowed the journalists to try them out on a little road course. Loads of fun. One of the most, perhaps the most fun I've ever had on a track, even though it went nowhere near as fast as some of the other cars I've driven. But just the fact that you could rotate it and play amateur Formula One driver in this thing made it a lot of fun. So I wonder whether they're planning something like that, whether they might, you know, actually market it this time, if there's some sort of road racing series they could kind of establish with that kind of car.
What was the car that Mercedes, what was it, FC or something like that, that was...
The leaner.
That was, so it was like motorcycle.
Yeah, that was truly a motorcycle. This is actually an open-wheeled race car with a motorcycle engine.
Didn't it have four wheels, the Mercedes?
I believe it did.
Yeah. What? I'm sorry. What?
It had four wheels.
It had four wheels, but wasn't it? It leaned like a motorcycle,
right?
Do you think
the approach that Honda's taking with this thing is just basically more like an open-wheel racing car? And we were talking about that last week with the no cockpit.
Well, you know, I was going to ask Stephanie that. What do you think? Is this Honda playing in the sandbox? They trying sandbox. To, you know, figure out, is there any demand for this? Or this is just to make the Honda image cool?
I think it's just by Honda image being cool.
Let's not forget one other thing. Had there been a much more successful season for Fernando Alonso and Jenson Button, they would be playing up the connection there. That's certainly part of it. It's been a disaster, but this is also
unmitigated.
It's also the first year back in F1 in a decade.
I know, but still, nobody thought they'd be doing this bad.
Exactly. Exactly.
Nobody thought Lewis Hamilton would be this good. Yeah. So.
But I bet just as Toyota did the Lexus LFA to celebrate the first Toyota F1 win that never happened, I'm guessing that. There was someone in marketing who thought that this would be a good tie-in with the McLaren Honda team.
Hmm. Yeah, good thought.
You know, it's sort of interesting to think about. We're talking about all these luxury cars that are going to be rolled out in Frankfurt, and so for the past few years, at least, the China market has been really the key market for some of these German luxury car manufacturers. And now the China market seems to be waning somewhat, I guess.
Leveling. It's just not growing the way it was.
Right. Not growing.
I mean, it's still big, but apparently the number of even luxury cars is not what it once was.
And even more importantly, everyone's cutting prices. So all the profits are coming down faster than car sales are not gaining as much. If that makes sense, to put it that way.
Well, if you hear that the crackdown on corruption has made a pretty big impact in China.
I think it's more than that.
It is.
The dealers have run to the government and said, we need a stimulus program. You know, they need their own cash for clunkers right now. The dealers claim that they're losing money, or at least certainly their profit margins are going down. I think it's a bigger story than what anybody wants to admit to.
Mm-hmm. Well, IHS came out today.
We did.
What'd you say?
We took our China forecast down from 4.4% growth for 2014 to 2015 down to 1.4.
That's huge. Mm-hmm. Because the government's still claiming like 7% for the auto industry, isn't it?
I haven't seen the government claim, but it's we've definitely seen it coming down.
Stephanie, you might have a different point of view, but my first thought when I see that it's still growth, but it's a big reduction in growth, is that okay? You've got brands like Buick and Audi, and a few other Western or Japanese brands that have established themselves in China, and Buick basically saved itself by going to China back in the late 90s. But in the last few years, you've seen other brands say, oh, they don't say this is our savior, but we think there's a great growth market there. So what it really means is it's the way to save Lincoln, for example. So how will that affect a company like, a brand like Lincoln going into China at this point when those other brands are already established and there's just no more growth for all these other companies that are thinking, well, we can just make it work with China?
It makes it more difficult.
It's always going to be difficult. Now it's even more so.
But Isn't there the possibility that there could be an advantage for Lincoln? Because as you say, these other brands are established and everyone pretty much knows what they are. And then suddenly these new products come rolling in from this company that you've not heard of before, but you know that is a storied American brand. And these things.
Great question. Are people tired of Buicks? They want Lincolns. I don't know. It's possible. The question is how well does Buick and Audi and some of the other established brands, how well do they update their products for China?
Because if you think about it, I mean, it was like about a year ago, we were talking about Ford being late to the party in China, but then they came there and their growth just was
very impressive.
Right. And so is this not a possibility the same thing could happen with Lincoln? Now, it could be like, okay, if you sold zero cars and then you sold two, you know, it's like, wow, look at the percentage increase. This is fantastic.
But one thing that you can be sure that will happen with China as the growth levels out is that there will be favorites played with the local brands, so local, and that could include Geely's Volvo as well. But certainly, they're now that the local brands are probably getting a little bit better and may even be able to compete on some level with some of the Western brands. You'll have an insularity in the country that would be similar to kind of the reaction we had in the United States in the 70s when the Japanese started to conquer. Our market here.
Yeah, wasn't it the case where the Chinese government was concerned that too many Chinese people were interested in BMWs and Mercedes and things like that,
and they
were saying, gee, you know, why don't you buy domestic cars?
Well, in fact, they put out an edict that government officials could no longer buy foreign-made cars. Audi commands that segment of the market, and I asked the CEO, Rupert Stadler, isn't that the guy? Mm-hmm. Asked him, well, what are you going to do now? I asked him at the LA show late last year, and he said, he pretended, like, no big worry. He says, about 10% of our sales in China go to those people, so, you know, we'll more than make up for it. But, if I'm a car company, I don't want to see 10% of my sales go away.
And this could be an opportunity for the Chinese government to basically subsidize people buying, indigenously made cars rather than foreign cars, even though they're all JVs over there.
Some opportunity. Mm-hmm. Well, and China isn't, their motorization rate, which I don't remember exactly what it is right now, is not nearly as high as it is here. So you still have buyers coming into the market, and that might be where your opportunity is for something like Lincoln. For brands that aren't established there, is you've got somebody coming into the market who hasn't had a car and maybe willing to go with a new brand and not committed to the Buick or the GM or the Audi that's been
Look,
here for
a while. I would not believe that Lincoln had a chance, except for what you brought up, Gary. Look at what Ford did in a very short amount of time in China.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only reason I believe Lincoln might have a chance.
And those dealerships look pretty cool, too. Give you tea, and you're good to go.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break here, give a shout-out to our great sponsor, Jeep, and we'll be back to talk to Dr. Data.
What will you be able to see in a Jeep Renegade?
Running wild and running free.
Everything.
And I say, hey, live it like we're renegade.
An available 2.4-liter multi-air engine that gets up to 31 miles per gallon highway. The available one-of-a-kind My Skyroof system. And a cabin that just won one of Ward's 10 best interiors. The all-new Jeep Renegade. Take off and take on anything.
Okay, we're back. And Gary, I'm sure you got some number to dive into.
All right, so earlier this week, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Stephanie and I were in Las Vegas to see the unveiling or the lifting out of a cylinder of the 2016 Prius. So this would be the fourth generation Prius. And so I began to wonder, I mean, we've talked on the show many times about how the sales of hybrid cars are going down, EVs are going down. Earlier in the show, we talked about how it's not even all that interesting for people anymore in terms of things like that. So I thought, let's take a look at how Prius is doing in the market. And so I thought, okay, we'll use 2014 sales numbers as a sense of where they are. And admittedly, Prius sales from 2013 were down 11.5%, according to auto data. And so Prius sales last year were 207,372. Okay, so this is the Prius family now. It's the hatchback, the V, the C, and the almost immeasurable plug-in version of the Prius, right? So we got 207,000 vehicles. So I thought, okay, let's look at some other things. Chrysler cars, so the 200 and 300, 170,745. All of Acura, cars and trucks, 167,843. Now, and they were up 1.5%, by the way. The aforementioned Lincoln, all Lincoln, okay? Cars and trucks, 94,474 units. So Prius, 207,000, Lincoln, 94,000. So come on, it ain't that bad.
You know,
seriously. I mean, you look at, you know, so I started looking at some other numbers. So I was looking at August sales numbers. So the 200 in August sold 14,000. The Prius in August sold 17,757. Chevy Malibu, 17,553. Ford Focus, 16,321. So even this car that is old, 6 years old, still doing pretty damn well.
Did I not say we kind of get into this whole, like, what's growing, what's not growing, and we focus on that? Maybe a little bit too much sometimes. We forget the context of the fact that the Prius does sell quite well.
Mm-hmm.
It's down from what it was, and hybrid, you know, in the hybrid world, it's doing better than anybody else is. And, you know, up and down matter. It tells you where the trends are, but it doesn't tell you the whole story. You certainly have to look at the context of segment.
Right. So what did you think of the new car? I mean, it was big razzmatazz. I mean, they really pulled out all the stops.
They did. We even had a band, right?
Yeah. From Australia, no less, that nobody apparently had ever heard of before besides members of the band.
Even they weren't sure.
The interesting, you know, we talked earlier about how green isn't a theme at the auto show anymore and how alternative powertrains are just kind of part of the landscape. This Prius is growing up a little bit. They're focusing more on driving dynamics. We didn't get to drive it yet, but they're
double
focusing
on rear suspension.
Right.
That caught my attention.
Focusing on driving dynamics, focusing on improving the interior and delivering
more than
simply fuel economy on that car. And that is coming partly out of the fact that it's a lot more competitive. Right now, we've got ICE engines that are getting close enough. I mean, the fuel economies are getting better everywhere we go. And even in alternatives, you're going to have more electrics, and you've got plug-ins, and you've got regular hybrids, and more diesels, and a lot of different things to choose from. Toyota Prius isn't the only name of the game, only name in town, in order to get an efficient vehicle anymore. So it has to deliver more than just efficiency. And as a model within that line, it needs to grow up. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing. The styling is a little, it's different. It's out there.
Well, it's got some of the, is it the Mirai? But to the point about how the Frankfurt Auto Show won't have many green cars, why didn't they save this for an auto show for either Frankfurt or Los Angeles?
It will be at Frankfurt. And we're probably,
got
mixed stories.
Yeah. Great. Why not have your big unveil at a major international auto show?
You know, it was tied in with a dealer event.
Right.
My guess is they sell all the Priuses here. They don't sell a whole lot in Europe.
They are mostly here.
Well, probably not a whole lot in Europe. And I mean.
Yeah, but they could have waited for L.A. where they sell all the Priuses.
Tokyo.
Right?
Or Tokyo.
The ones that they don't sell in San Francisco.
Yeah. Well, except for the L.A. show is in mid to late November.
Yeah, maybe too late for it.
Yeah, and I think the car is going to be out.
They got to do something
now. So the car is going to be coming out.
I know it's a lot of volume. The car is dying. They got to do something.
But it's not dying. Come on. Is the Focus dying?
The Focus is dying.
All right.
They're moving it to Mexico. They can't even build them here anymore. Look, here's the thing that Toyota's got to do with the Prius. They got to attract more than hybrid huggers. They've been unable to do that. This is exactly why Chevrolet is changing the styling of the Volt to make it more mainstream. This new Prius kind of looks, when you look at the new generation Civic coming out, the new generation Volt coming out, it fits right in with that. And what GM's own research has shown is the general public doesn't want to stand apart from the crowd. They really don't when they're in the mass market. So will this Prius attract buyers who just want a nice little car to get around and are not saying, oh, my God, I got to go out and buy a hybrid?
So this is the Volkswagen Golf of green cars. This is a car you're selling to people who are faithful to A, Toyota, and B, to Toyota hybrids.
Right. That's what it has been. And this is part of growing up. It has to broaden that audience.
Yeah, because, you know, if you look at the whole green car segment, it's never really gotten above 3%. It might have a month here or a month there, but it's locked in. And, you know, people buy a hybrid, and then they get a plug-in, then they get an electric, and then they go get an Escalade or something like that, it seems. But they're not increasing that segment. And unless they can start growing the entire segment, it's dead. It's just a little niche that's never going to be any more than it is.
Well, this stuff becomes more relevant when it is simply a powertrain option that you go into your dealer and say, oh, I want that one because it's got these features and I like that. And, oh, what does it have under the hood? Oh, well, that's fine. I put gas in it? Yeah, okay. That's good. I'm happy.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
Well, to me, like I said, if they can get, you know, people as interested in a Prius as they are in, say, like, they go shopping and it's like, geez, what should I get? Should I get the Corolla? Should I get the Camry? Should I get the Prius? You know, because right now people are going in and say, I want a Prius. I want a hybrid. And unless they can break out of that mold, this new one, I don't think is going to sell that well.
Actually, they're going into those Toyota dealers and saying, I want a RAV4. But
yeah.
Goes back to what Todd was saying earlier.
I looked at some of the conquest defection numbers on Prius before I left. And over the last couple of years, when this one kind of came out in 2010, it was grabbing a lot of Camry buyers. Obviously, they when you look at any of them, you conquest from your own make more than you do anything else. But over the last 4 years, more people are going in and rejecting the Prius and going for the Camry. And that is something that is definitely changing within the makeup of that.
I don't have any data.
So Prius isn't able to conquest the way that it used to. And that's something that Toyota needs to deal with.
What I've run into, and this is purely anecdotal, I don't have any really good numbers to back it up, but in just talking to people who have been hybrid buyers, mm-hmm. and you ask them, you're going to get another, a lot of times they'll say, no, you know, I want to try something different now. And the unstated message is, I did my hybrid thing.
Sure. And, well, I mean, how many, there are people out there, but it's not the majority of people that buy the third and fourth and, you know.
Maybe we should start trying to talk them into convertibles.
Maybe.
Yeah, there you go.
That's
bring it all the way back. I mean, really, if you want something
really
different.
Convertible
crossover. As I say that, we talk about the Miata, and would I be actually be into my third Miata in a couple of years? It could happen.
All right, so Monday, the UAW has to announce its strike target, right?
Well, I think it's the 16th. Is it Wednesday, I think, is the official day the contract expires.
Next week.
14th.
Yeah, next week. They got to say it, right.
14th.
So what's going to happen?
Ooh, I have no idea.
Should we be taking bets or point spread for whether it's going to be Ford or GM or Chrysler? Fiat Chrysler, sorry, FCA. Boy, I mean, it seems like they might have reason to choose any of the three for various reasons, including, you know, Ford switching over the – well, they're going to put the Ranger production – where they were doing the green cars, which is kind of interesting.
The Focus and the C-Max,
Focus and the
right.
C-Max, which I think they helped.
Replacing those green cars with a pickup truck, for God's sake.
Well, what do you think, Gary? What do you think is going to happen?
Okay, I think that it's unlikely they'll go with FCA.
I was just... Okay, we'll debate this. Go on.
Well, Because FCA is in the weakest financial situation of mm-hmm. of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's one Buckingham Research came out and said that it would be probably General Motors, and one of the rationalizations was that Mary Barra's father had been a tool and die maker for Pontiac Division for 39 years.
Buckingham, what? I've never heard of these
therefore, guys. Therefore, she would be more sympathetic to the union than Mark Fields
That's
would be or Sergio Marchionne.
We ought to get into the business.
I'm telling you.
Kidding. Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, it's between those two. But you obviously think it's going to be FCA.
Look, I can build a case for all of them. But here's my case for FCA. It has the most Tier 2 employees of everybody.
Like 40-some percent.
Yeah. If I'm the UAW, I got to cap that right now. And if I can get a cap at FCA and cap GM and Ford, woohoo, I'm to the good. Also, the profit-sharing formula at FCA sucks. You know, I need more profit-sharing for my people. You know, the brothers and sisters at Ford just got $40,000 over the last 4 years. You know, the FCA guys have gotten nothing like that. And to your point, FCA is financially the weakest of the three. You put a gun to their head called a strike, man, they're going to have to jump. You can't dare shut down that Ram or those Jeep plants, you know. To me, FCA is the weakest of the three. What? If I'm the union, I attack where they're weak.
And Mark Chione has been most vocal about how he doesn't like the two-tiered.
But what's the trade-off?
Well,
he says, "Oh, we got to get rid of that.
We can get rid of the top tier. We'd be in good shape, right?"
I'm putting my hand on my wallet if I'm the UAW. Yeah. To make sure it's still there.
This is the thing I can't understand. Okay, so he wants to make this change. All right, so he has the greatest number of people in tier two, right? So what tier two you hire in at like $16, and if you're Legacy, it's something like $28, right? Right. Now, the $28 people have not been able to get a raise for 10 years, right? These guys want a raise.
Yep.
Right?
They're
going to
get it.
They want a raise.
Yep.
Now, the tier two people, now he says it's untenable to have these two wages. Are the legacy people going to say, we'll take some of our we'll give back some of our $28?
No.
You know? No way in hell.
What will be the effect?
How can they do it?
What will be the effect, though, the other kind of the outside factor, the fact that after this contract ends, UAW workers will be able to opt out of the union because of the
right to work. That's going to be fascinating to watch because, right now today and for years, in fact, the UAW has represented plants in right to work states. Mm-hmm. Texas is one that comes to mind. And there's a bunch of others. Still, well over 90% of all the employees in those plants in those right-to-work states stay in the union. The difference now this time is that if you look at the Mackinac, what is that thing? It's this conservative think tank.
Yeah.
They're going all out of their way to teach UAW members, here's how you drop out of the union. Here's the form you have to send in. Here's the process that you got to do. And I'm blanking out on the name of the anti-union or the anti-UAW group that's also in it, Volkswagen. They have set down shop here, and they're trying to cherry pick workers off the UAW roster. So, it's interesting that in other right-to-work states, the UAW hasn't lost that many members, but you haven't had an active anti-union organization trying to entice people to drop out of the union.
Well, I think all that's going to happen well after next week. Now, maybe what will happen is that General Motors and FCA will merge between now and then.
By now and
then. Well, could it happen well after next week, but if there is a strike, it could happen while the strike's going on. I mean, the contract ends.
Because the contract ends. I mean, their strike is not the only.
So you're saying if they go on strike, that somebody's going to say, "Damn it, I want a job. Therefore, I'm going to drop out of the UAW." And what was it? The Teamsters came out on Labor Day and said, "Our trucks will not. If you guys go out on strike, we're not going to go into the plants."
Oh, really?
Yeah. James Hoffa Jr.
Yeah.
He came. He said, We're supporting our brothers and sisters at the UAW.
I don't think there's going to be a strike, or if there is a strike, it'll be like a cursory strike. So you can go back to the radicals in the union and say, we shut them down for a day, or two or something like that. So much of this is just pure theater. You know, the UAW is a political organization. You get elected to be in the union, a representative. They're as political as the Republicans or the Democrats. They'll promise their voters whatever they want to hear. And to me, it's just a lot of it is just like kabuki theater, no theater. It's all pre-planned.
And it's kind of interesting, the kind of little concessions that the Detroit Three have already given in terms of first Ford saying, well, we're going to pull these products out of Wayne, the Focus and the C-Max. And then a little while later, after the UAW kind of reacts and says, what? We're going to put the truck in there. And then, there was that long, protracted discussion about whether or not Toledo would shut down because
Marchione might pull Jeeps out of Toledo entirely, and he says, no, we're still going to build Wrangler there. And now you've got General Motors in Spring Hill, Tennessee, apparently putting up billboards trying to attract the non-UAW Nissan workers.
Skilled trades.
Skilled trades.
Because there's a huge shortage of skilled trades.
You know,
huge.
We can't lose sight of the fact that, you know, at places like Wayne, where Ford has its facility, or the Toledo, where the Jeep complex, and Spring Hill, where Saturn used to exist. I mean, they spent a lot of money on building these factories. And so it's not one of these things where you can just go, you know what? We've had enough. Let's leave, you know?
Build a new one.
We'll put the for rent sign on the door because nobody's going to rent that place.
Yeah.
And it used to be that you could have old equipment that you would sell in another part of the world, and people say, oh, yeah, I'm very anxious to have that equipment. That looks very nice. They don't want that anymore. They want the new stuff, right?
Well,
so you just can't leave. I mean, it's not that easy.
Mm-hmm. And that's to John's point, there's a lot of theater. I mean, what we're reading about and what we're seeing and we're deriving what we think means from whatever headline there was, I'm not in the UAW room. I'm not in the negotiation room. And the people who are, they're not necessarily talking about what's going on in that room. And I think we have a lot of theater. And I don't think we have a really good sense.
Speculating about Hillary's emails.
What I'd love to know is, and we, you know, I think with the calculator, the four of us could sit down and figure it out. What is your labor cost bill per car maker? And I wouldn't be surprised at all to see that you spend more money on steel every year than you spend on UAW labor.
Yeah.
And yet when GM or Ford or FCA sit down to negotiate with the steel suppliers, they don't go through any of this kind of stuff. You know, none of this theater, none of the pounding, all this, you know, run and leak stuff, none of that happens.
Right.
And it's just a peculiarity of when an automaker is bargaining with its labor supplier that you get into this theater that, you know, has got a history that goes back to the sit-down strikes of the 30s. And you've got to show, as the union, you're tough. You took management down. You stopped them just to placate the radicals. And the companies have got to say, hey, we're moving this to Mexico. So Wall Street goes, oh, very good move, very good move. And I'm sure Dennis Williams at the UAW knew as soon as Mark Fields made the decision about the Mexico thing. And in fact, I'm sure Mark said, hey, Dennis, I'm going to have to make this announcement. And Dennis was like, cool, I'll sit on it for a while, and then we'll figure out what we're going to tell them, what's really going to happen, i.e. the Ranger coming into that plant.
Right.
So it's...
I think that after going through the recession and going through all the things that we've had over the last 15 years, which has kind of changed the relationship between the UAW and the auto workers, I can't believe that the union is learning about any manufacturing move from a press release.
Right.
You just can't.
Well, that's true, of course.
You can't manage the relationship that way.
That's great. Well, so, to the point, sure. And but the difference now is that, remember that 8 or 10 years ago we talked about how Detroit had a built-in, what it was, $2,500 per car disadvantage because of the UAW costs, especially the what's now the VEBA. And so in the time since then, everything's been restructured, and you have the Detroit companies making some pretty good profits. So the question is not, well, how much more does steel cost than the UAW, but how much more of that can we get back and not hurt and not put GM and Ford and Chrysler in the position they were in 2008 or 2009?
Right.
And I would like to have been in their room when the steel guy was negotiating with Ford about the F-150 pickup. There was a lot of Sturm und Drang there.
There was a lot of theater in that one. Right? You're right, Jerry. You're right. Hey, look, before we got to wrap the show up, but we actually got some questions here, and I hadn't looked at it until right now. So, real fast, this is rapid fire. Maverick wants to know, any of us driven the Colorado diesel yet?
No.
Not yet.
No, okay. None of us have seen it. He's hoping that he's... can tow a 5,500-pound max trailer. Wondered if 7,000-pound is okay. But we don't know any of that yet, do we?
No.
Okay. Jimmy Dorf wants to know, for green, because we were talking about so much green stuff, what about this 107-mile range 2016 Nissan Leaf?
We forgot to talk about that,
didn't
we?
Yeah.
27% increase in range from the... but they're still offering... It's just a bigger battery. So it's the same powertrain, bigger battery. Go farther with the bigger battery.
And depending on the model, it's a $5,000 to a $7,800 upcharge to get that bigger battery. So
right.
Now you get a bunch of other stuff. That's not just the charge for the battery. But Okay, Armin wants to know, is there any technology debuting in Frankfurt we should be looking out for? I don't think so. Comes out of this connected car, autonomous car, subconference. I don't know of anything.
I have to look at my list. I can't think of anything offhand. Audi A4, the diesel version, will come to the U.S., apparently. That's about the only thing.
Okay. And then finally, Mike Ma out in San Francisco says, don't you think convertibles, there are not convertibles because of the cost of development? You can't just chop off the top without reinforcing other parts of the car, unless you're like the Corvette where they designed it to be a convertible from the very beginning.
That's right.
Yeah, I think that's a big difference between different sports car convertibles that are designed to be sports car convertibles and those that start off as coupes.
Yeah, you can't turn any car into a convertible very easily.
Although I can't remember whether you mentioned...
Green?
I can't remember. Did you mention the Mercedes S-Class convertible? Obviously, that's going to be a big, relatively heavy car, and will certainly absorb the cost.
Okay, one last fast fire here. Mike Ma wants to know, what do you guys think about the chatter of Cadillac planning to drop the LT4 640, 650 horsepower supercharged 6.2-liter V8 in the Escalade? Do you think this might mean an LF4 for the upcoming XT5? Which is the SRX replacement. Yeah. And boy, if you aren't into this industry, nobody understood what I just said.
And I don't have an answer.
Yeah, okay.
On the one hand, the Escalade makes all kinds of sense if you look at what the Germans are doing. On the other hand, it makes no sense because it's just a big, big truck. And, I don't know. I don't know about having something that big able to go that fast, that quickly.
I'm sure the Cadillac finance people have plugged the numbers into their economic model, and if it meets their net present value cash flow, bingo, it'll drop in there.
True, but
otherwise,
You have to ask the question, why hasn't it happened already? I mean, the Escalade's been around since the late 90s.
They can't build them fast enough.
Because they're working on the convertible thing.
And with that, we'll wrap it up. So, Steph, thanks so much for coming on. We'll see you in Frankfurt.
Yeah.
Todd, we'll see you over there, too.
And for John.
Gary, you and I will be traveling a lot together next week.
We will.
Good.
Well, we might see each other as we're passing between the 9 or 10 halls we have to cover.
Yeah, these shows, you see the same person every 15 minutes, and somebody else.
People should tune in next week, though, because there will be at autoline.tv.
Yeah, we'll be posting up a whole... There will not be an after hours next week because I'm going to be flying back. I don't know if you're coming back that day or not. But, Gary's right. We'll have a lot of stuff being posted next week right from the floor of the Frankfurt show.
Hey, if you have a connection on the plane, after hours at 9 p.m. European time as you're flying back.
There you go. There you go. Real good. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by the all-new 2015 Jeep Renegade.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.